The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
It was the biggest one-day point drop in 2 years on Wall Street as the nation's top retailers warn price spikes are affecting their bottom line. Target announced a 52% drop in profits last quarter, blaming the growing costs of gas and transportation. Its stock lost a quarter of its value. Other retailers took double-digit hits following Walmart's stock performance yesterday, the worst in more than 30 years.
What will cause an end to the selling? No one can pick exactly when it's going to happen, but what is it going
to
be?
It's going to be Jay Powell saying, forget that I ever said 50 this, 50 that. Right now, 100 basis points, and then if it doesn't cool, we're going to do another 100. No more Mr. Nice Guy Jay Powell. He's got to step up and stop the price increases.
You've been banging the drum about the Fed being too late. Is a recession at this point now unavoidable in the U.S.?
It is not unavoidable, but unfortunately, the probability is going up. What is unavoidable is stagflation.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The S&P 500 briefly dipped into bear market territory on Friday before the bulls stepped in to defend what looked like bear market territory. While it was a good way to finish the week, it was a bad week overall. The S&P 500 fell 3.1%, the NASDAQ was down 3.8%, followed by the Dow Industrial Average down 2.9% and the Russell 2000 down 1.1%. The two major catalysts this week were disappointing economic releases as well as terrible investor responses to earnings from some major players in the retail industry. Diving in here, the May Empire State Manufacturing Survey turned negative, down to negative 11.6, and the Philadelphia Fed Index dropped to 2.6, near flat, when expectations were for 16.5. The Conference Board's leading economic index dropped 0.3%, signaling difficulty ahead, which has been adversely affected by declines in consumer expectations and residential permitting. Residential home sales for existing homes fell 2.4% in April. Building permits also fell 3.2% last month. And we'll get new home sales next week, but those too fell 8.6% in the last reading in March from February. So we're not expecting the trend to improve just yet. Weekly jobless claims jumped up 218,000, all negative news, unfortunately. While the retail sales number for April was up 0.9%, these sales are not adjusted for inflation, so rising prices aren't helpful and can mask true growth or contraction. Supply constraints are still a factor and confidence has fallen. Most of the growth came from motor vehicles and parts, food services and drinking establishments, as well as non-star retailers. Despite the positive announcement, it was weaker than the last three postings, which were 1.4% or better. But investors weren't listening too closely to the economic reports of strong retail sales. Rather, they were concerned by earnings announcements from Walmart, Target, Ross Stores, and Home Depot. Home Depot actually had some good results, but mainly traded flat. Walmart missed by 18 cents on earnings, but beat revenue expectations. They lowered their fiscal year 23 earnings per share guidance, but raised sales guidance, with the CFO seeing consumer behavior changes due to inflation. Their comments about lingering food inflation pressures helped lead into investor sentiment on inflation, may have peaked recently, but will remain stubborn. Earnings from Target really worried investors on Wednesday. The stock fell almost 25% after the company missed earnings per share estimates and talked about elevated cost pressures, echoing comments that we received from Walmart. The CEO, Brian Cornell, cited stresses from unexpected freight and transportation costs when he was interviewed on CNBC. COVID and reopening buying habits are adjusting, as the CEO commented on softness on big margin items like TVs last year have now shifted to luggage this year, with the category up 50% and toys also up due to birthday parties recommencing. But the main concern came from the fact the company does not plan to raise prices despite higher costs, drawing major concern to profit margins, which have dropped from 9.8% a year ago to 5.3% in the first quarter. The takeaway is that the consumer is spending money in reopening ticket items and falling in stay-at-home style items while inflation pressures are hitting profit margins. Ross Stores also added to the ongoing inflation and profit margin concerns that caused investors to sell stocks on Friday, with the stock finishing down 22.5%, which also pointed towards inflation pressures that contributed to disappointing guidance. We also continued to get supply chain concerns from Cisco, Applied Materials, and Deere that contributed to negative reactions to earnings reports this week. Lastly, we heard from Fed Chair Powell, who continues to talk a tough game on inflation. He said specifically the Fed will need to be more aggressive with rate hikes if inflation does not come down in a clear and convincing way. Obviously, echoing his previous comments from last week, as well as there's been some concerns about inflation may have peaked, but the Fed is not ready to ring the bell on that one. And Fed President Esther George said the Fed isn't focused on the impact of rates on the stock market. Like other Fed officials, they're watching the weakness, but that's just serving to help in the primary function right now and is part of their efforts to create tighter financial conditions. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Up next, guest John Kosar to talk about the technical backdrop.
As we've moved through COVID and as we've moved through some of the supply chain issues, customers are clearly reconciling what they need to do, not in 2022, but more in 2032. And this involves not just nearshoring and outsourcing, it involves where they want to be in terms of automation. You can do 6 to 7x in some cases what the human hand can do, whether it's via robotic arms, whether it's via vision technology, whether it's via cobots. Warehousing has fundamentally changed in the way people thought about 20 years ago to what the warehouse of the future is today.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stocks have been in a deep nosedive. How far does this go? Is this a major bear market? And is more damage ahead of us? Let's find out. Joining us from Asbury Research is John Kosar. John, why don't we take it from the top? You have a lot of key indicators. Let's go through those and just give us an update what they're telling you now.
Sure. Our main two that we use for tactical to us is where you get in and get out when you enter and exit. Strategic is the move you're trying to catch. So our tactical tools, actually, I just went just a few minutes before you and I got on here together. I went back and listened to the last time I was on the show. It was January the 20th, and our Asbury 6 and our correction protection model, CPM, had just gone to risk off on the 14th. They are still risk off. They're still negative, and the market's dropped 800 points or 17% since then. But they're still negative. So we don't know exactly where the bottom is. I mean, we draw on our support lines and we look at 100 different things here at Asbury Research, but as it sits right now, the tactical part of our analysis is still negative.
And you have your protection model too. So what's that saying?
And that's been risk off also since the 14th or maybe the 15th. Those two are usually side by side with each other. The Asbury 6 is a little bit more transparent, I guess you'd say. It's a little more volatile. That's updated every day. And we built the Asbury 6 because I've been doing this for 40 years. But in my view, the character of the market has really changed just within the past 5 years or so, where if you try to determine what the market is thinking by looking at the S&P, all it's going to do is make you dizzy. You know, we're up about a week ago as a poster child for that. That Thursday, we were up Thursday of last week, exactly 1 week ago, we were up 120 on the day in the S&P. And then Friday, we were down 130 or 140. So we backtested a lot of my favorite tactical tools. that I've used throughout my career and when I was on the trading floor. And we found those that worked very well at letting you know what the internal condition of the market is. And we found six that work very well together. By very well, I mean, every indicator has its Achilles heel. There's no indicator that works all the time. So we found six that tend to pick each other up. If one or two are off and aren't really giving you a good signal, an accurate signal, the other ones pick it up. That's the Asbury Six. And again, that's been negative since just about a week after we talked in January. And with very, very few exceptions, all six of those are still negative. And we update that every day on our website.
Well, John, I'm looking at the S&P, the major indexes, and about the only thing that's in an uptrend is energy, but just about everything else is breaking through long-term moving averages. So do you see anything outside of energy that's looking attractive here?
You know, I've been turning over rocks here for weeks trying to find something that's doing well. We have another model called the SEEF model. You and I talked about it when we were on in January. SEEF stands for Sector ETF Asset Flows. And that went overweight energy on the 4th of January. It's still overweight energy. And energy outside of maybe 0.2% higher year to date for utilities, energy is the only one that's made any money all year. And our model shows that money keeps flowing into energy. So until it stops doing that, you know, we're going to stay overweight. Since January the 4th, I just had written this down, energy is up 38% outright, and it's actually outperformed the S&P by 66% since January the 4th when the model went overweight. So there's not a lot out there other than that. I'm looking at housing. Housing is giving some early indications that it may be beginning a new relative outperformance trend versus the S&P 500, but that idea hasn't hatched yet. It hasn't performed to the point that I think you should start to put some money there.
Let's talk about something that is in a short-term rally mode here, and that's a 10-year treasury. We got to 3%. It's been rallying recently as the market has gone through stress. What's your take on interest rates here?
It's been a really interesting one. The yield of the 10-year actually broke out from 170. It had been going sideways for about a year or so, and it broke out higher from 170 at the beginning of January, actually just about a week before you and I talked last. And that gave us a target of 225. So it got to 225, it stalled there. 225 is actually a downtrend line in the yield of the 10-year that originates in the year 2000. So we kind of stutter-stepped around that 225 area for a while. And then the next level on the chart was 320, 330. And we stopped at 325 a couple of weeks ago, just about a week ago, actually. And we've come off of that. I did not think that 325 area was going to be broken on the first shot. It's too long. It's too strong of a level. It's been around for years. So it looks to me that we're likely to get a move back down to 265 and possibly all the way back down to 230. The way the 10-year moves, it tends to stay in one place for a long time, and then it has these very sharp, aggressive moves. So to me, 330, if we get through 330 on the top side, that could really open up the door for much higher rates. I think the 120-year monthly average on the yield of the 10-year is about, if my memory serves, 440, about 4.45 or 4.5%. in terms of yield. But for now, I think 330 held. And again, the first level is 265. And I think 230 is viable. If we can get back down to 230, that might be a place to look to sell the long bond again, because that's going to be a formidable level that I think is likely to hold yields. If we do get down there, that might be a place to do some business.
You know, John, as I look at these Fed rate hikes, the market's pricing in basically 50 basis point hikes at each Fed meeting. We just had our first in May, which is probably the largest increase we've seen in decades coming from the Fed in one meeting. It's expected June they'll raise 50 basis points, another 50 in July, and another 50 in September. I see it really hard to find that we're not going to be in a recession as we get into the fall. You're seeing housing rollover. Some of the unemployment claims are starting to rise. What's your take in terms of the idea that maybe by fall, the Fed's going to be forced to pivot if we're in a deep recession?
I try not to get too far over my skis. It's very difficult. It certainly is for me to try to handicap all of these unknown things that we don't have a lot of control over, like what the Fed's going to do, or a short time ago is what's going to happen with COVID. What's COVID going to do with the economy, or how is the situation in Ukraine going to affect food production over the next 6 to 12 months? There's so many moving pieces there. Moving pieces of unknowns. It's virtually impossible to put that all together into some kind of a cogent forecast as to what's going to happen 3, 6, 9 months down the road. So what we do here at my shop is we just follow the data. Really simply stated, we're following the money that's moving around the board. And the story often comes after that. So the story so far this year has been higher volatility, underperformance, relative underperformance by all the places in the market that usually lead, like semiconductors and small cap and both of the NASDAQs. You're getting outperformance. We have been overweight steel earlier in the year. Soybeans, the last time that you and I talked, soybeans was a place that we had put some money to work in soybeans because we saw the market was going lower here, and we were looking for some of the commodity space to give us an opportunity to make some money while the S&P 500 was in a downtrend, looked like an emerging downtrend back then. Soybeans has very quietly outperformed the S&P by 34% since the beginning of the year. So what we do, rather than try to forecast all these moving pieces in the economy, is we look at a broad swath of ETFs that cover equities, overseas equities. We talked about Peru and Mexico the last time that you and I spoke. They've both outperformed by about 15 or 16% versus the S&P. So we watch all these relationships and we watch the asset flows that are moving around between all these assets, and we follow them rather than try to figure out what the economic story is going to be.
So given this and given where we are right now, if we were to hit, John, a bottom in the market, because, you get those washout days, capitulation days, breakdown of the leading indexes, what are key things you would be looking for to tell you that it's safe to start dipping your toe back into the market?
Fantastic question, actually. Just before I came on today with you, I was going through charts just to see what's really current and what's relevant right now. And I think what's relevant right here is you've got 5 or 6 really important individual stocks or important indexes that are sitting on some really important support levels, formidable levels that, maybe go back a year or two. And you're seeing that in Apple. You're seeing it in Amazon. You're seeing it in HGX, which is a housing index that I had mentioned a little bit ago. You're seeing it in the SOX and in the Russell 2000. So the SOX is often a leader during a bull market. The Russell is often a leader. Apple clearly is a leader. So if we can hold these support levels in here over the next week or two, you have very bearish sentiment, which is also bullish. It's kind of a inverse indicator in the sense that when everybody is really bearish, and just look at the last Investors Intelligence data, it's very negative. We're at a place where you might see a top form. Some of the options volume data is very negative. So if these support levels in these places hold that I just mentioned, I would be watching the VIX really closely, because the market has a hard time calming down to the point where it could start to move higher when the VIX is over 24. 24 is a number that we really look at here at Asbury. So if you see Apple, Amazon, housing, small cap, and semiconductors hold up in here over the next week or two, and you start to see the VIX come back down under 24 and stay there. I don't know if that's going to be the bottom, but that would certainly look like a tradable bottom to me.
So given that, and is there any time dimension when you look at these kind of things? You know, we have these seasonalities that we see in the market. Typically, you know, the old saying, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day. And then we usually have that strong finish at the end of the year with a little bit of turbulence in September and October. Any seasonalities that you think could play in here?
Well, the seasonality is negative right now. I look at seasonality as kind of a tertiary indicator. I look at it like if the market's a bicycle and you're on your bicycle, I look at it as which way the wind's headed. If you're riding your bike, you know, and the bike is the trend of the market and the wind is in your face, seasonality is in your face, seasonality is going the other way, I think it could temper the move down. In the second quarter, the last 3 weeks of this month of May and the last 3 weeks of June are the sixth weakest weeks of the entire second quarter seasonally based on data going back to 1957. And September is, like you said, the sell in May and go away. That's seasonally the weakest month of the year. The first part of October is usually a little dicey, and then things get stronger as, you know, the market strengthens into the end of the year and the first part of January. So yeah, the seasonality is not doing us any favors right here for sure.
So if I was to sum up right now, John, you would say, you know, you're still in that protection mode and you haven't gotten all clear to go in or even take partial positions right now.
That's pretty much it. I mean, where we've been, again, we've been overweight energy because of our CEF model, and that's really done well for us. I've been in and out of soybeans, and I've been looking overseas, Peru and Mexico. There's a couple more. I don't remember what they are off the top of my head, but we've been investing. When I see that the U.S. market is down, you know, we're in a downtrend. Simply, the S&P is underneath its 200-day moving average. Our tactical models, you know, the correction protection model and the Asbury 6 have been risk-off since January. I start looking overseas for places that I could use as alternative investments. Our U.S. versus the world model tracks 24 different foreign markets versus the S&P 500. And last week, we update this once a week. So through last week, 11 of those 24 were outperforming the U.S. on a monthly and also on a quarterly basis. So we've been putting some money overseas to try to at least capture some relative outperformance while the S&P 500 is on the ropes like it is now.
Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow Asbury, because you really get some in-depth research, how could they do so?
The best thing to do is to visit the website. It's asburyresearch.com, and we'll send you some sample research. It all comes in one email. Some information about our models, how our models work, how they've performed over the past decade. We've got some informational videos. We'll send you links to those about different aspects of what we do for our clients. And we always have a Memorial Day sale. We offer 10% off of our 3 and 12 month subscriptions. That starts tomorrow, Friday, and it'll run through Monday, Memorial Day, which is the 30th this year. So yeah, there's some stuff going on there, but feel free to contact us. You could use the contact tab on the website and say you listen to us on Financial Sense, and we'll send you some info, and we'd be happy to talk with you.
All right, John. Well, listen, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Stay well and come back again.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on today's Smart Macro Edition is Chris Poplava, our CIO here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, as we've been discussing since the beginning of this year, and really since late last year, You were very cautious and defensive on the market, talking about how we'd see market turbulence and some major volatility ensue, given a number of things that we've been reiterating here on our show for the past 5 months or more. And today, on the day that you and I are speaking, it is Friday, May 20th, we did see a further large decline in the market intraday, taking us beyond that 20% quote-unquote bear market threshold that a lot of people reference. However, we did see a rally later in the day, so it looks like we've now gotten back above that level. But year-to-date, we're down 18% on the S&P 500, 14% on the Dow, and the NASDAQ is down 27%. I know that you've been talking about eyeing a 25 to 35% decline in the market as a reasonable downside target. We're definitely getting closer to that level. So kick things off for us. Let's start talking about the weekly investment meeting where you discussed about how the economic backdrop and the fundamentals that you're looking at are really giving very low odds for a soft landing in the economy without a major Fed pivot. So what it is you're looking at and telling investors currently?
Well, when we look at the 1970s onward, we've had 9 Fed rate cycles. And in 7 out of those 9, ultimately the Fed raised rates sufficiently enough to kill economic growth and cause a recession. We only had 2 of those that ended in a soft landing, meaning the Fed was able to cool the economy without causing a recession. And what was present in both of those cases, the mid-80s and 90s, is not today, which is labor slack. The other thing as well was if we go back further, all the way back to World War II, we've actually had 3 soft landings going back to that point. And in each of those soft landings, the one in 80, 90, and the earlier one before 1970, we saw inflation at much lower levels. When we look at inflation above 5%, we have never not landed in a recession. So in the 3 soft landings, we had labor slack and we had lower inflation than we see today. And I think part of the other thing too, Chris, is, you know, we're already starting to see signs of stress, but I don't think the conditions are there for a Fed pivot. For example, you know, as we just mentioned, the inflation annual rate is running at about 8.3%. The ISM manufacturing index is comfortably above 50. And when we look at the prior Fed pivots that weren't dealing with inflation, essentially we needed the ISM to stall, basically, which is 50. Anything above is expansion, below is contraction. And so at a current reading for April at 55.4, we're still a ways away from where the Fed may start to get spooked by the pace of economic slowing. So that's why I still think we're well away from the Fed pivot kicking in. However, given where I think the ISM is headed, I do believe the ISM will be likely approaching stall speed later this summer, which may be where the Fed finally begins to pivot.
So Chris, as I said in the open, you know, you have been eyeing a downside target for the broad market indices, if we're sticking to the US markets, around that 25 to 35% range, with the Dow probably closer to the 25, and then the NASDAQ getting hit a little bit harder, close to that 35. What are you looking at near term when it comes to capitulation levels? You know, whether or not, I think you and I would agree, and most of our listeners would understand that we could see at any point in time an oversold counter trend, you know, bear market rally develop. But longer term, what are some of the things and the indicators that you're looking at on how you see this market playing out for the remainder of this year?
Well, in my opinion, we really have not seen essentially the market capitulate. And we often see the market capitulate before the Fed does. Now, what I mean by that is, yes, stock prices have fallen, but what we haven't seen is what stocks are basically forecasting ahead. So stocks are responding to tighter financial conditions. However, analysts have not budged one bit on their earnings expectations for the S&P 500. For example, when we look at earnings estimates for the S&P in the second quarter, they're going to be at a record level and then followed by a further increase in the third quarter. So when we look at earnings estimates for the S&P, they have not come down at all. And so one of the things that I'm concerned about is when you look at the ISM, it has a pretty close correlation with the 12-month earnings growth for the S&P. So if we had an ISM dip to stall speed, we would expect a much lower estimated growth rate for S&P earnings. And as of now, that's not being priced in. So while, yes, stock prices have fallen, earnings estimates have not budged. And I think the problem is when analysts are expecting a rosy outcome, when they don't get it, there's a shock. And we saw that recently with Walmart's earnings, Target's earnings, which disappointed. Those stocks were down double digits on the day they reported. There was a clear shock compared to what was expected from the market and reality. And I think we're going to be seeing that on an index level for the S&P, where analysts have yet to dramatically slash their earnings estimates. So that's one of the key points I feel is that Wall Street has not capitulated on their outlook for this year, even with falling stock prices.
Okay, so to summarize your view and what we've discussed so far today, you know, two of the nine past Fed rate raising cycles have been soft landings. The conditions that exist today do not exist that we saw in those two. So the odds are pretty highly stacked up for us facing a hard landing. That is a recession. And as you've said before on our podcast, over the next 12 months, so higher probability for a recession. Wall Street, as far as you see, when you look at earnings estimates, have not priced in this economic weakness or recession yet. So there hasn't yet been signs of capitulation by the major banks, by Wall Street collectively. So it sounds like in that case, you'd be, again, even though we could see, technically speaking, an oversold rally develop, the primary trend as you see it is still down.
Absolutely, Chris. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, you and I talk about time and time again is what are the credit markets saying? And for me, often at times during bearish trends in the market, when we have those counter trend rallies, usually the credit markets don't budge. In fact, often at times they continue to decline. We saw that in 2018 when we had a mini bear market. We had rallies in October, November, yet credit markets didn't budge. And then ultimately the market hit new lows. And for me, Chris, what I'm really concerned about is the impact of the dramatic rise in interest rates and commodity inflation, food and energy costs that are hitting the consumer. And, you know, looking at the credit markets on certain sectors, for example, the consumer finance sector, we are seeing credit default swaps on individual companies balloon to levels not seen in some cases since the March 2020 crisis, COVID-induced crisis. And what is concerning to me up further is that we're seeing a greater amount of stress in individual companies' credit default swaps than in the stock price themselves. What that implies is that the credit markets are basically expecting stock prices to eventually catch up and head much lower. Some of the risks that we're seeing, Chris, are in major companies like Ally Financial, Capital One. Even American Express, interestingly, is showing signs of stress. And so that is one of the big concerns I have, is I have not seen stress levels peak in the market in general, and in particular in financial stocks tied to the consumer. When we look at Capital One, for example, their credit default swaps as of this morning were at 138 basis points. That is higher than 2018, higher than the stress we saw in 2016, and roughly half of what we saw in 2020. But they're going vertical. And it's not just consumer finance stocks. It's also in consumer discretionary stocks. We are seeing significant deterioration in names such as Ford, Gap. Gap, actually, the credit default swaps on Gap, believe it or not, are higher than during the great financial crisis of 08, higher than the 2011 U.S. debt downgrade, higher than the stress seen in 2016, and also higher in 2018, and higher than, literally, they're almost approaching the 2020 levels. So, you know, retail consumer stock Gap is showing a lot of stress. Macy's, same story with Macy's. Macy's credit default swaps are going vertical. The other scary one that I was looking at this morning was Nordstrom's credit default swaps are well above 2018 levels, and they're not that far off from levels seen in March of 2020, as well as the 2008 great financial crisis. So for me, Chris, things are moving in the wrong direction in the credit markets. And until I see a significant healing that the worst is behind us, it's hard for me to get bullish on the stock market, even if we have counter trend rallies. So in my opinion, until the credit markets change, I think any rallies in the stock market are likely to prove to be dead cat bounces.
Chris, I want to thank you for coming on to Smart Macro again. Give us an update on your outlook, and we look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
So as Chris has mentioned in prior Smart Macro broadcasts, we are sitting in high levels of cash here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. We are overweight materials and energy, but we are taking advantage of buying opportunities as they emerge in the credit market space where we find attractive yields while some of this volatility exists in the market. If you do have any questions about what we're doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management or would like to get in touch with any of us to speak about how we can assist you either with financial planning or asset management, feel free to give us a call at 888-486-3939, or you can go to our website, financialsense.com, and hit where it says contact us.
Well, despite hovering inflation hitting four decade highs, the metals markets have been reacting to the downside. What's going on here? Let's find out where the future leads us. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, you know, if you would have told me we would have been hitting four decade highs and we would see lower gold and silver prices, it would have been hard to believe, but that's exactly where it is. And I wonder if we might begin with just how small this market is. I don't think people realize it doesn't take a lot of money to move into this market to move it. And likewise, when money moves out of this market, it can send prices down precipitously.
The gold market makes up about 1% of the entire financial landscape. If you look at what silver is in the financial scheme, it is 0.02%. So silver is obviously an extremely small market. And prove the point a couple other ways. When Eric Sprott started the PSLV, I actually was there in Toronto with him about 6 weeks before he launched it. He launched it, I forget the first tranche, but the first tranche of metal was a significant amount for a retail investor. It was either 10 or 20 million ounces. I think it was 20, but you can correct me. But in that buy, the delivery was late on the last amount coming into the vaults because basically they had to manufacture it and ship it over. So that shows you the tightness in the market. Back in that time frame, we were probably mining somewhere around 500 million ounces at that time. So if you're only going to buy 20 million out of 500 million as far as what the annual production is, that gives you an idea of how small this market really is. And even a percentage-wise small amount of physical purchase can actually have an effect on the market itself.
Dave, explain to our listeners, we have the price of silver, which is between 21 and 22 bucks. But if I go to a site like, one of the gold sites, they've got a 1 ounce silver eagle going for $36. So you're talking about this huge premium of a coin. I know the government puts in, what, a 6-8% markup on the coins they sell. But how can you explain $36 when silver's at 22?
You can't, Jim. It's greed. It's really unfortunate. It's very upsetting. I mean, it's pervasive. It's throughout the whole dealer community. And it's really, really sad because it really negates the function that, you know, I've expressed about silver pretty much from when I started on, you know, in the mainstream. And that is that, you know, silver really is money and it can be used as such. But when you have something that you've got to get a 30% appreciation to break even, it's not as bad as Bitcoin being used as money, but it's similar because you can't, a coin should have no spread. I mean, when I was a kid, and I think I'm a bit older than you, Jim, but I mean, I took a silver dime and there was no markup. That was the money. And the closer you get to a zero spread, the better off you are as far as a monetary transaction is concerned. So it's not only the eagle market, which you just explained, it's also in the bars and the privately minted medallions, and even junk silver has got a huge premium on it now. And I could explain all of them. I mean, they're all too high. The junk silver bag market's pretty tight right now, but it's supply and demand and what these dealers are willing to mark up with and the public is willing to pay. I mean, as you know, I use a dealer that has a rather more realistic view of what the spreads are, but there's still a spread. He's got to eat like everybody else. But it really is upsetting to me. It's only been recently, meaning January of 2021, I guess, when the Wall Street silver crowd started. It was obviously extremely tight in the silver market. Both the SLV and the SLVR changed their prospectus to basically read that we don't have enough silver, but if, and because of that, here's how we're going to account for it. And then the price got up near 30, and it hasn't gotten really close to 30 ever since. And yet the demand side for physical, as expressed by the Silver Survey, World Silver Survey from the Silver Institute, showed that we had on aggregate more demand. So if we have more demand on a constant supply, the price should have rose, you know, should be higher, and it's not.
So, Dave, when you take a look at these prices, 36 when silver's at 22, and you find it all across the spectrum when you go to different dealers, why is it silver? And also we're seeing huge premiums in the gold coin market as well. So it's not just silver, which is, you know, the premiums on silver are much, much greater given the price of silver versus gold. But still, there's a huge premium in gold.
There is. It's really a market that's bifurcated, Jim, as you know. We are really talking about two separate markets. We're talking about the gold bullion paper chase on the COMEX or the LBMA, and the same with silver. And those prices are set for a derivative. It's a contract to potentially take delivery, which happens about 1% of the time. And so the retail market, which is the physical market in both gold and silver, is basically what the market will bear. And since it's really tight on that side of the market, the spreads are big and, you know, getting bigger. They've shrunk a little bit. I just talked to one of the main dealers on the wholesale side, and the shipment has gone from about 4 weeks average to 2 weeks. So that suggests that there's more supply, but there's no sales. I mean, it's all the sales are on paper. The reason, part of the reason, Jim, is that, you know, they've got to get inventory for new buyers because no one's really selling, even though you could go into the futures exchange and say, oh, look at all these sales. Oh, my goodness. You know, the open interest has dropped substantially. The commitment of traders look very good. And it looks like it's time to get on silver story again because silver's, you know, set up for another run up. And it is in the paper market. But as far as the actual retail market, it hasn't changed much. People have been buying silver all the way through, and very little sales are taking place in either gold or silver.
You know, the silver market has always lagged, and it's always been, in many cases, some people say manipulated. I remember when you exposed me to silver back in 2001, silver would trade, you know, 350 to 5. At 350, they would go long. At $5, they would go short. Until I think it was mid-decade, and it finally broke out above 5.8, and then on its way up eventually by 2011 when it hit 50. But it's never been there since.
Yeah, well, the manipulation, and I'll use that word, you know, occurs across the entire supply chain. I mean, it's the physical market. Obviously, someone that's in the retail business is going to hedge, you know, the price of silver. But the major institutional holdings are hedged. The bullion banks, the Bank of England, the entire retail market, and all that goes through, again, the futures markets that's transparent for the most part, which is the COMEX, and the opaque market, which is the LBMA for the most part in the over-the-counter markets. And these markets are vast, and these guys, so I'm going to use an analogy, Jim, and hopefully it'll make the point. So if you are hedgy, if you're looking at a loaf of bread, the adage is that there's like 13 taxes on that loaf of bread from the time it goes from the farmer to your dinner table. You could say the same thing in the silver market on the hedging side, because miners will hedge. Now, maybe Pan American doesn't, but the big producers, like byproduct mines like RTZ or BHP or any of these other huge conglomerates that mine a lot of silver, and yet on their balance sheet it means next to nothing, hedge. Or they call it free cash flow. There's a lot of accounting tricks. But that's hedge. So there's a paper contract against it. Then it moves to the refiner and he hedges it. And then the refiner moves it to the dealer that's going to stack it on their shelf and they hedge it. And then the retail guy that buys it from the bar and puts it into a coin form, he hedges it. And then when it's on the coin form and it's sitting in inventory at the wholesaler, he hedges it. So there's this propensity to short silver again and again and again. And this puts downward pressure on the market. And no one really talks about it that much. And I'm not saying hedging's wrong. I'm actually not against it. What I'm suggesting is that that silver flow is something that it's basically sold again and again and again until it finally gets purchased for an end product, be that something like silver wire for a cell phone, which doesn't really use wire, but, you know, for silver industrial purpose or for an investment purpose. And that's when the final hedge comes off.
You know what really strikes me about this? Just as we are on a fiat banking system where $1 deposited can turn into $10 in credit in the economy, Dave, it reminds me with the silver and gold precious metals market, because the physical market is so strong. In other words, if the hedge funds, instead of trading SLV or GLD, actually went into the physical market, start taking delivery, they would overwhelm it, and there wouldn't be enough silver in the warehouses or gold to honor these huge bets that these hedge funds make. Because you probably know this better than I, how big is the precious metal paper market compared to the actual physical market?
At least 10 times. I'm convinced that the silver market was cornered. I put cornered in quotation marks, Jim, years ago. And here's the reason. If you look at, for example, what happened just in 2020, and you look at either CPM Group or the World Silver Survey from the Silver Institute, they pretty much match. And what we had in 2020 was 320 million ounces was bought in the ETPs, ETFs. And another 200 million was bought by the retail investors. This year, I haven't studied both of the surveys. I just got both by PDFs. I've looked at the World Silver Survey briefly. But I know the number, and the number is around 260 million ounces in retail. So it went up like 30% or something. I'm doing the math in my head. We went up substantially from 200 to 260 on the retail side. But on the institutional side, we went up 60 million ounces. Now, 60 is one-fifth of what it was the year before, but it's still aggregate on the increase. So if all things being equal and truthful, you had more demand in the silver market from 2020, end of 2020, to the end of 2021. 65 million in institutional, and yet the price went down. And so this is without a doubt a data point that I can make a hard case of, anyone that understands what I just said, that something is amiss in the silver market. And it's been that way for a long time. I remember, I've been thinking about our interview, I was driving back here to the office, and I thought, you know, I remember talking to you probably more than a decade ago. And I made the corny analogy that if you took, you know, all the paper certs for silver that people really believe is physical, I mean, it isn't like these people are in the future. These are people that get a statement from their bank or their vault or their dealer that says you own this bar and you know, we're safekeeping it for you. I'm talking about that. If you took every one of those pieces of paper that people truly believe in, and believe they have physical silver, and put it on one side of the 50-yard line at the Rose Bowl, as is my corny example, and you put all the silver on the other side of the 50-yard line, there's a huge mismatch. Is it 10 to 1? I'd say it probably is. So what's happened is the hypothecation in the paper market and these dealers working together, I'm not talking about the retail dealers like your, you know, bullion dealers, I won't name any. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the bullion banks, and I'm talking about their accounting methodology, and I'm talking about the ease of which they can at least double count silver. And here, let me prove that real quick. If you look at the SLV and you read the prospectus, they are allowed, and I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just pointing out a fact, that they're allowed to take a warrant. Warrant is a fancy name for a warehouse receipt, and put that into their SLV as a physical trade. Well, what if, just as a thought experiment, all of the silver that's sitting in XYZ vault, well-known vault, maybe a custodian even, has not only that silver there that they're counting and showing on the COMEX inventory, but they also hold the warrants to all that. Well, that's double counting, and it's legal. And I'm not saying it should be illegal. What I'm saying is they aren't the same thing. If I have 5,000 ounces in my basement and I've got a warrant for it, it's representing that same exact 5,000 ounces. But if I give you the warrant and say, hey, Jim, I want to borrow money on this, and you say, well, sure, I'll give you 50% of the value of the silver. I think that's pretty safe. And you're holding a warrant. Where's the silver? Well, it's still in my basement. Yet I've hypothecated that silver and done what with it? And that goes on and on and on. And it's so bad. And it's close to, I won't say it's as bad as, what happened in The Big Short when we're looking at the credit default swaps. And if you remember that part of the movie, folks, I know all of you haven't watched it, but I'm sure most of you have. And you're sitting behind the dealer watching the blackjack players doing the primary betting. And then you've got people standing behind them that are making bets on their bets. And then you have people standing behind them that are making bets on the people that are betting on the primary bettors. And this is how it goes in the system. And that's why I'm not a fan of Warren Buffett so much, but nonetheless, I'm not against him. But when he says that these derivatives are, you know, sitting there as a means of financial mass destruction, he does know what he's talking about there. And this is part of the problem in the silver market. As you said, there could be a day of reckoning, but it's pretty tough because at the margin, there's enough bars to meet demand almost always. Although the arbitrage opportunity is huge. There's two things that could happen. One is you need an Uber type of situation for the silver market where somebody comes in with the free market idea of having like a national exchange where the bid-ask spread is amongst physical metal people themselves. It could be dealers, it could be refiners, it could be the general public. So everybody comes together and you see what's in the inventory. If you want eagles, you can bid on eagles. If it's rounds, you can bid on rounds. If it's 100 ounce bars with a certain mint, you can bid on those. And people that are selling back won't be getting hammered by the paper price only. And people that are buying would have to compete with others that are willing to sell in the open market at a free market established price between two parties. So that's number one. And number two is, of course, what I've been harping on from the beginning. And almost, I don't feel guilty. I just think it's my calling. But, you know, where is silver relative to the monetary sphere? And obviously, the banking establishment, in my view, has done a great job of obfuscating the whole idea. When I did that series of lectures about 3 or 4 years ago, what if silver were treated like gold? It would have a whole different paper price. And the reason for that is there's probably, at best, the equal number of silver in investment form as there is gold, but it's probably around half. Most of the analysts in the alt media believe there's about 5 to 6 billion ounces of gold in investment form and somewhere around 2 to 3 in investment form in silver. But if we just doubled it and said it's the same as gold and the silver market was considered a monetary asset like the central banks consider gold to be, what would they put on their shelves as a monetary asset? Well, if they put silver on there, obviously the price would be much different than it is now. But since it's treated as an industrial commodity by the banking establishment only, and money on, let's say, the free market thinkers that are willing to look at silver as what it used to be, the whole world was basically on a silver standard, then, of course, we've got this idea that there could be enough people that say, you know, I'm tired of what's happening to the U.S. dollar. I'm tired of what's going on in the stock market. I don't like my bond portfolio. I'm not sure that this corporation, the zombie corporation, is ever going to be able to pay me back. And people start exiting. And the flow will go to gold, especially with the big money. But there'll be a spillover into silver like what happened in 1980. And I believe that it's going to be big. And the reason I believe that is you have the internet. It's not a group of wealthy investors from Texas and some of their Saudi friends that are buying silver. It's going to be pervasive. The problem is, can the market keep up with the demand? The answer is probably not, because it's got to go into the retail side. So the other arbitrage opportunity is for someone with some fairly deep pockets to start taking COMEX bars off and minting them down into, you know, 10-ounce bars or something. I just finished touring the Sunshine Mint in Las Vegas. I've been to the one in Coeur d'Alene about three times. The first time I went to the one in Las Vegas, and they can't keep up with the demand at all. And they run 24/7, 7 days a week. And the working conditions aren't the best. It's a huge warehouse and it's not well cooled. They have cooling in there, but you know, they're pumping out as much product as they possibly can at that facility, which is one of the largest around. And yet they are far behind where the retail market could be poised. So set a mouthful, Jim. I'm sure you've got some ideas to throw back at me.
Yeah. One of the things that hits me about the gold and silver market compared to other assets, how much of, let's say, the lag in gold and silver is due to the proliferation of investment opportunities? I mean, if you compare the 70s, there was the coin market, but there was the futures market. And of course, we had stocks and bonds. So people bought gold stocks. Today, Dave, you have ETFs, mutual funds, ETFs for almost every single commodity, every single asset class, every single market around the globe, including cryptocurrencies. So how much of all of these outlets for investing makes it a little tougher on the precious metals market because there's so many ways you can invest today?
Yes, you hit the nail on the head, Jim, and it takes you back. I'll tell you another quick story for our listeners. I remember one of my first trips to the CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. I was actually walking out into the building, and there was Rick Santilli smoking a cigarette leaning against the wall. And I struck up a conversation with him, and basically it went like this. I'm getting right to the point. I told him who I was and what I did, and he said, "Oh, I don't know. Not anymore," because he just outlined what you did, Jim. And this was way before there were a lot more products now than there was probably whatever this was 15 years ago when I talked to him outside the CME. He says, "Look, there's so many other areas to invest in now. I don't know if gold's ever going to get a bid." You've gotten, he just outlined what you just did. And it's gotten, as I said, even greater. I think that I still think gold and silver have their day, and here's why. There's so much leverage in the system, and people are going to find out that these allocated and pool allocated accounts, when things get tough and they want physical delivery and it's really not there, that's when you're going to hit the fizzy hits the dizzy on what's really happening. And it won't take a lot for that to take place.
So given where we are right now, silver's down in the 22 range, gold's around 1800. Given this market, the premiums in the coin market, what would you be doing as an investor if you wanted to get into precious metals?
Well, the best leverage and the best way to really make your money work is in the mining sector. I mean, you're not, you know, there's not really like a huge spread. And you also get, you know, I've made more money in paper silver than I ever made in physical silver. So, you know, if you look at what I did with, say, Pan American or what I've done with First Majestic several times, I buy it in a situation like this as a trade. And silver goes up from, let's say, this 21 area up to 26 or 7, which I fully expect it to do here in the near future. Whatever that percentage is, you can about triple it and you'll get that out of First Majestic. So that's really where the leverage is. And it's, you don't even have to margin it to get pretty good returns. The problem I have is me. I've always been an advocate for honest money and honest weights and measures, and I'm really for a financial system that's fair to everyone. And to have that, you've got to have money in circulation. And it doesn't have to be coins passed hand to hand. It could certainly be as the old days with the silver certificate, where there's a definite relationship between what's held in the depository and what's out there in the currency market. And you can do that now with the blockchain quite easily, and there's really little room for fraud. Whereas in the wildcat banking days, there was plenty of room for fraud. And what I'm saying in an indirect way is some of the sector of the silver market is committing fraud. I'll just give you a quick example. Back in, I think it was around 12 years ago, there was a lawsuit. One of the bigger investors, investing that Morgan Stanley had bought silver from Morgan Stanley and was paying his vaulting fees month after month, year after year. And somehow he wised up or got suspicious and he found out that that silver wasn't there. And Morgan Stanley, basically in their appeal, in their explanation, told the courts that it was standard practice in the industry to have not purchased silver or vaulted. In other words, they were using derivatives to prove that they had coverage of this guy's silver, but yet they were charging him as if the physical silver was bought and was being stored. Oh, and they only got a slap on the wrist and a fine. If it were me, of course, I am an advocate for honest money. I would have said, Morgan Stanley, you are never allowed to trade in the silver market for the next 10 years. You pull crap like that. But when they're bold enough to say it's standard practice in the industry, that gives you some idea of what I've been working on with others as far as trying to expose what's going on in the metals industry, which is rather frightening.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, tell our listeners about your website and the Morgan Report and how they can contact you.
You bet, Jim. The easiest is the landing page, themorganreport.com. Please get on our free list. I'm getting hit more and more with the censorship, meaning that I may not be on YouTube much longer, which I really don't care. I've got backups. But the best way to get to me is be on the mailing list, and that I can put everything off of my own server. I am on the backup channels like Odyssey and I think BitChute and some of the others. I don't know. My webmaster takes care of all that. So I'm not going down for the count. It's just I might not be on the mainframe. I am on Twitter. I'm pretty active on there. Most of the stuff that I post that's controversial, I do it in picture format because the algorithms don't pick up pictures. So if I want to say something rather profound and maybe not something that Twitter algorithm might not like, it gets passed by. So thanks for the opportunity, Jim. I still have a free service and a paid service. And I've quit consulting, although if you're really desperate and you go through the consultation page and say, hey, could you make the time? I usually do, but I just can't afford the amount of time allotment based on all the work I do for our subscribers.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as always, pleasure having you on the program. All the best and come back again.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.